Hello, it's Doug Jane from The Last Record Store. Our guest is singer-songwriter Rodney Corral. Rodney is no stranger to Sonoma County. His band, The Cherry Bombs, with Roseanne Cash, performed at the End of the Beginning in Cotati in the early 1980s. He read from his memoir, Chinaberry Sidewalks, at the Montgomery Village Copperfield Bookstore in 2011. And tonight, Rodney Corral performs at the Mystic Theater in Petaluma. Rodney, welcome to KSRO.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thanks for coming back to the county. You've got a new album. You got a new album called Texas, and last year you put out a record called Acoustic Classics. That was just a very pared down, low production revisit of a lot of your songs. And this new album, Texas, is really kind of like a concept album. Can you talk a little bit about the new album?
Well, concept. If it is a concept album, it conceived of itself, because that particular record actually started with a conversation with Steve Earle and I that lasted 25 years, a long time ago, around the time of, well, in the late 70s when I was living in California. I wrote a song called Brown and Root, Brown and Root, which was a construction company that Halliburton eventually bought. I used to work for them in the summers, and Steve started performing that song on his first tour when he went out. So we talked about recording it together for 25 years. And we finally got around to, we got in the studio, you know, a year ago, actually in the end of August in 2018. And we recorded it, and we said, well, that's a start. And then a series of events happened. I got a text from Ringo Starr's people inviting me to his place to record a track if I wanted to, and I was on the next plane. Not literally, but the first one that we could arrange. And then a conversation with Billy Gibbons that had been going on for a while about, you know, he and I grew up in Houston around the same time. I finally had a song that I thought worked for, you know, in that ZZ Top Texas Boogie feel. And so those three things happened rather quickly. And from there, I was off and making a record. And then collaborations just started happening. For example, Leanne Womack just happened to be stopping by the studio where I was working to have a meeting with my co-producer, Ray Kennedy, about something else. And I said, hey, what are you doing? And can you stay for a minute and help me with this song? And it just started, it kept happening. Like, same thing, I was talking to Vince Gill on the phone about something else. And I said, what are you doing today? I'm going to the studio, and then you want to come by? There's the last song I wrote with Guy Clark. I'm going to record it today.
Oh.
And Vince was a good friend with Guy. And as well, and so he popped over. Not to make going too long about this, give your chance to speak again, but that's just the way the record made itself. We just kind of watched it happen, you know, and just participated in it. So it was fun.
Well, it's cool that you mentioned Leanne Womack, because her last album was just really great, her recent record.
Yeah.
And Ringo Starr, I got to ask you, you put out a song, did a song called Earthbound many years ago off an album called Fate's Right Hand.
Mm-hmm.
And Ringo Starr gets a shout out in the song as one of the reasons worth living is that you start listing these people like Ringo Starr and Tom Waits. And
stuff. One of the reasons.
Did you talk to Ringo about that song? Does he know about it?
Oh, yeah. I would imagine. I had met Ringo in the 70s when I was with Emmy Lou and Harris and the Hot Band, and we spent a wild night in London with Ringo one night, which he claims he doesn't remember.
Oh, thanks a lot.
But I would say it started with Earthbound and me name-checking him, and you know, same thing, I developed a friendship with Mary Carr. We've written nearly 20 songs together just because she heard her name in a song, and it kind of opened the doors. It's, you know, maybe I should do that more.
I think so. You know, I remember this morning that back when that record was new, Tom Waits lives in the area, and he shops in our record store. And I actually put a copy of Fate's Right Hand in his hands and said, "You get name checked on this album." And I'm not sure. Yeah. I don't remember whether he bought the album or not, but he was impressed.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, I would say that Tom Waits is the only. Let's see, who would I say? Tom Waits, Aretha Franklin, Mary Carr, Walter Cronkite, Seamus Heaney, Ringo Starr. Tom Waits is the only one of those names that I don't have any, I haven't had any personal contact with, or I don't know him. I've never, of course, I admire his work, you know, deeply. But the rest, you know, Seamus Heaney and Walter Cronkite, I had an evening with Walter Cronkite, and I've come to know everybody that, you know, did a show with Aretha Franklin at the White House with Emmy Lou. So that song, you know, the prophecies in that song have pretty come to fruition, all but for Tom Waits. So I think maybe it's best that, you know, there's somebody who's got to, you know, stay outside the loop. So might as well be Tom Waits.
Might as well. So I'm talking with Rodney Crowell. He's performing tonight at the Mystic Theater in Petaluma. And folks that are listening that aren't familiar with Rodney Crowell, he might sound familiar to you if you watch the Ken Burns documentary, Country Music, because Rodney is one of the very prolific talking heads that Ken Burns uses in the film. How was that experience for you, Rodney?
Well, Dayton Duncan did that interview, and Dayton was, you know, that was pretty much his brainchild, I think. You know, and he works in the under the Ken Burns umbrella. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all know that if it's Ken Burns' documentary, it's going to be really well done. And I'm always a fan of Vietnam and baseball and the Dust Bowl. And, you know, they just do Vietnam. It's just superb documentary. So I was really happy and delighted to be invited to, you know, to take part. And I remember the interview, but, you know, sadly, so far I haven't seen the documentary yet. But I've certainly got a lot of phone calls, and I've even been stopped on the street by people, you know, just stopped me and said, "Hey, you know, I just watched the Ken Burns video on Country Music, and you were a vital part of it." So I guess I should say I'm grateful and delighted.
Well, you come off real well. And one of the cool things about it is every promo I've seen, because, you know, leading up to the them airing it on PBS, they show little promotional clips, and you are in every one of them. I have not seen a promo for Country Music without Rodney Crowell talking about Three Chords and the Truth.
Oh, yeah, I didn't remember my quip, but apparently I said it's Three Chords of the Truth, even if it's a big fat lie.
Right. I did talk to Ken Burns, and he did interviewed him as well. He told me that he actually does some of the interviews. He interviewed Dolly Parton. So he's able to pick the people that he wants. But Dayton is,
who can blame him for that?
Yeah, Dayton is amazing as well. So tonight when you play at the Mystic, I know you're playing with a couple different hot guitar players. Can you talk about your backup fellas?
Well, as it, you know, I have a trio formation that normally have a violin / fiddle player and a guitarist in my trio, and I have a couple of Aussie guitar players that normally, according to whose schedule is the most busy, one or the other would normally be the other part of the trio with the violinist, and but the violinist is off somewhere with Emmy Lou, and so tonight I have two supreme guitarists, you know, a couple of Aussies, Jed Hughes and Joe Robinson, and they know all my songs really well, and we're able to to get on stage and actually, and we did our first show together in this particular form the other night, couple of nights ago, and it was an adventure, and it was a lot of fun. So I don't think that I think it's really a vital and fresh performance for us because we're kind of exploring and arriving at different musical things, you know, on the fly, which it's really amusing and entertaining to us. And I always feel like if we're really being entertained by what we're doing, there's a much better chance that the audience is being entertained as well.
I saw a similar lineup that you did a few years back at when you played in Napa, and you had Will Kimbrough in your group.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
having just the guitars really brings the lyrics out. I mean, sometimes when there's a band, it takes away from the lyrics a little bit. But your songs are so lyrical, and they bring up such great imagery. And I want to ask you a little bit about your songwriting. Do you ever get writer's block? Do songs come easily to you? How does it work?
Well, I don't get writer's block mainly because I don't acknowledge that is an actual thing, or it hasn't been anything that I experienced. Although, you know, I have literally worked 20 years on one song. there's a song on Tar Paper Sky called Fever on the Bayou. Really kind of a simple song that it took me 20 years to discover the last verse that it needed. And I mess with it off and on all that time. There's a song on Close Ties called Tied to You. That was 17 years in the making.
Good work takes time.
I don't get discouraged that I can't uncover what it is. And I'm working on a group of songs now that I'm going to start recording in December when I finish up this tour out in the West and heading up in the Northwest. And I started writing most of these songs back in January, and they've come pretty quickly, but some of them, you know, that I started back in January, I'm still working on. Mm-hmm. But it seems like I'm really close to getting them done. So to get back to your real question about this is, I don't ever experience it as writer's block. You know, you're probably a writer yourself. You know, I wrote a memoir. It took me 10 years to write, and I learned a lot, you know, when I might spend 3 weeks on one paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
The patience that, you know, and it's like spend 3 weeks on one paragraph and just not be able to find the rhythm and the tone, and then take two words out of it, and suddenly it's there.
Yeah.
And, you know, for that 3 weeks, those two words would not volunteer to step out of the lineup.
Mm-hmm.
So I approach it that way.
Rodney Crowell is with us, everybody. He's performing at the Mystic Theater in Petaluma tonight. Now, you are one of the only people, I don't think I've ever talked to a person that has won Grammy Awards in two different centuries. You got a Grammy Award back in 1990 for the Song of the Year, After All This Time, and a second one in 2014 for Old Yellow Moon, Best American Album. So congratulations.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Well, I've also, I hope this doesn't sound undecorous, but I've had music on the charts, either songs I've written or something I'm recording in every decade since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I kind of look at that and say, ooh, boy, that speaks to, you know, at least, you know, whether it's longevity or some kind of consistency, I'm pretty sure that whoever does publicity on me is going to start bandying that about, you know, trying to drive that point home.
Well, it's a marvelous career that you've had, and you've been in our consciousness since the 70s. A year that was really crazy was 1988 when you put out a record called Diamonds and Dirt. seemed like everyone was coming into the record store and buying it. It was all over the television, videos and such. And I believe you had like four or five number one songs on this record.
Yeah. There was five number ones in a row there. Yeah, that was interesting, and it was a heady time, and a lot going on, and you know, that would be the commercial peak in my career, and it didn't turn into, you know, I didn't become a superstar by any stretch of the imagination. I think I had 15 minutes of stardom. But within a short time, I settled back into kind of middle class performer. I'm comfortable in that realm. It seems to work for me because the worst thing that about that kind of commerciality or that kind of commercial success for me was that I got pretty self-conscious for a while there. You know, you walk into a room and when you're kind of that much in the forefront, you walk in a room and people kind of project on you that you're that guy. And I found myself taking on a persona that wasn't really so much mine. And it felt like if I stayed in that mindset that my ability to grow as an artist was going to be jeopardized. I don't know how I knew that, but I just instinctively knew it. So I was pretty happy when it, of course I would have liked the money that would have kept coming in, but I was happy that it tapered down to something that was more creatively manageable for me.
It almost reminds me of like a journeyman baseball player that makes it to the World Series and hits three home runs and helps the team win. It has the greatest game of his life, and then kind of goes back to just being a guy on the team after that. But country music has done such weird things. I mean, country music stations, like when you came out with your first solo album, which was like 1974 or
78.
Johnny Cash is not played on the country stations, but Emmylou Harris is. And now Emmylou Harris and Rodney Crowell aren't played on a lot of country stations, but are played on Americana stations. I mean, what is your take on all these genres that have popped up and where they move people around?
Oh, well, you know, it's radio, they're not selling music, they're selling ad time. So, you know, I always thought, look, you know, if you're going to be a radio programmer, you should have to have a degree in musicology. You know, I mean, but that, I was high-minded about it, you know, thinking, well, you know, you should know, why Art Tatum and Gwendy Harden are important if you're going to program music. But of course, that's not what happened. You know, people wind up in that job who may not really care that much about music. They're just doing a job. And then this thing came into the music business of the consultants. And, you know, the consultants were getting paid to like what they liked. So, you know, that's just the way this happens. But hey, Emmylou is still working. Rodney Crowell's still working. John Prine is still working. And by the way, back in the late 70s, Emmy wasn't getting played that much on country radio.
Mm-hmm.
She got some, but, you know, it was like Emmy was, and Graham Parsons, Emmylou, and John Prine were the first Americana artists, which is, you know, people with kind of a country flavor with a poetic sensibility who don't get played on the radio. And I had a period of time there where I got played on the radio a lot, and over the years I've written quite a few songs that got played on the radio by other artists. But basically my role in all of it is that, you know, I'll be at the Mystic Theater theater tonight, and it's a really manageable, beautiful size room. You know, it's not, you know, it's not the local Coliseum, but, you know, I'm a middle-class performer, and I'm working.
And people love you. Rodney Crowell, good luck tonight. Great talking to you. I'll see you at the show tonight, and thanks for talking to us at KSRO.
Good, man. Appreciate it, yeah.
All right. Bye, Rodney. All right.